to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, director of content at Steinway & Sons. If you enjoy Soundboard, please rate, review, and subscribe to it wherever you pod your casts. This episode of Soundboard was recorded live from the Big Ears Festival, held each March in Knoxville, Tennessee. Go Vols! Steinway & Sons is the official piano of Big Ears. My guest today is jazz pianist, composer, performance artist, and Steinway artist, Jason Moran. I was going through and came across your Africa Bambaataa cover, which I missed. That was like 2000, right? 2002?
Yeah.
The first hip-hop album that was really like you know every track, you know every beat
from, wow,
what was yours?
I mean, that's tough to say because there were kind of like a lot of them. I mean, growing up in the 80s, I mean, everything felt brand new, and I'd say the one that maybe had the most impact, Run-DMC's first record, was kind of incredible.
Raising Hell,
yeah, just hearing some of these beats on it. But the record that changed me was Public Enemy's first record, Yo Bum Rush the Show. And they had a song called My Uzi Weighs a Ton. And, you know, I mean, this is how when you get to a certain age, then you start talking about stuff that doesn't happen anymore. Like, they used to play the song on the radio and you just had to catch it. That took effort.
Yeah. Record it with your tape recorder over open air.
Yes, you know. And, but they, that song was like the top song of that time in Houston. And I just remember my brothers and I listening to it in the kitchen while my older brother did the dishes. We were like, I was freaking out. And Public Enemy, over the next few years, they would become so central because they tied this incredible music, but also to like all this history. So it was not empty music. I mean, a lot of music was really built and full of stuff, but P.E. particularly put a lot of gems in the lyrics. And so I felt like I could learn as much about history as I was learning in school from listening to their songs. And that definitely set me on a path. Yeah, all of it. They used to treat me like Coltrane, insane, you know, like all these things that he talked about. And also they reflected my mother's and father's bookshelf. So how Black power was collected in these books and radicalism was collected in these books, in these texts. And everybody of that generation was reading it. And P.E. is kind of like the children of that generation. So that's what you hear in those songs. And I know it amplified my relationship to the music I play today, because then it said, well, when you're playing a certain style of music, particularly Black music, it's coming with a lot of relationships that may not be only written in those notes. And they may be ancestral. They may be about community. They may be about struggle. They may be about joy. To me, about spirituality, but they are in there. They're not, you know, separate. And that made learning music a lot more fun and meaningful.
I think that's a theme for you, is wedding the past and the present into the future.
Yeah. I mean, look, no one that I really love has been able to divorce themselves from relating to history. And it's not that any of them showed up saying, I'm a history major. It's like I show up as an artist, and part of the artist's job is to not only understand where they are, but it's also just because you're studying techniques of the past, even to make what you do, then you have to study the anatomy, or you have to study harmony and rhythm. These are just things you can't get around, and they'll endlessly be fascinating from every century, you know, to the ones coming. It's endlessly fascinating for us. So it's not what I thought I'd become when I was at Manhattan School of Music as a student. I was like, yeah, I'm going to be the guy digging into the past. No, I did not. But I sure enjoy it.
Just because we started with hip hop, that was unintentional, but I was just thinking about it because of the Africa Bambaataa song. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about how, okay, they took a sample from Trans-Europe Express, from Kraftwerk.
Yeah, just this time to chase your dreams. About the seats, make your body sway. Socialize, get down, let your soul lead the way. Shake it now, go ladies. It's a living dream.
Love, life, live.
Come play
the game.
Our world is free.
Do what you want, but free.
Had this.
Yeah.
There was a global thing happening.
Yeah.
And sampling before Who's Sampled, which is this great site / app that you can just go to. You had to know. You had to know that like Wu-Tang was sampling Black and Tan Fantasy because you recognized the Duke Ellington record.
Yeah.
And then and then you could be like, yeah, that's this.
That's this. Yeah.
And that was a voyage of discovery.
It was. And I guess, you know, like, I also know that the voyage of discovery for a young musician today is still as fruitful. It's still difficult to find these things, you know, just because then the information is given to you doesn't mean the search is over. You know, like just because you type it in doesn't mean like now you understand it. Nah, you actually still gotta like, if you really want to know, you're going to have to do a little bit more work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for every generation, these, I've only been feeling like I could feel a little bit less anxiety about the future generation or the generation coming up now. It's because I work with so many of them. And so I watch how they do their investigations. And my God, I'm not thankful. Even my son the other day, he said, Dad, you know, when you're going through the, you know, the turnstile at, you know, on the subway, you don't have to open it up to your wallet. You can just tap the bell button on the side. I say, what?
Yeah.
Sometimes just hang out with somebody younger just so they can teach you some shit a little bit more efficiently.
Yeah, that's right.
Sometimes it's more efficient. Sometimes it doesn't solve all the riddles of the world. But I got to say, they know some things.
Let's go back to when you said, just because you punch it in and you we can't see you, but you made a typing motion, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important distinction, is that Googling is not research.
No, it's not. It's
and
not.
I don't want to say back in my day, but back in my day, you had to go to the library. You had to go through the card catalog.
Yeah, yeah.
You had to get your microfiche and take pictures of that microfiche and Xerox it like you were a spy, like you were like you were pulling together a dossier.
Yeah.
And that was research because that card catalog, while I was on my way looking for whatever, I was going to run into other things.
That's right. That's
Jason,
true.
And that's something Google's so great and so targeted.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't have those happy accidents of, oh, what's this?
I think now the accident is the algorithm. People think, oh my God, how did you know I was thinking about that? Eh, well, we monitored all your emails and all your text messages and we listened to every conversation you have. So we know what you're thinking about.
Your fate is decided.
So, you know, I think sometimes we think, or at least I know I do, like, oh my God, how did they know? It's not a mystery, bro. The real young musicians who have that curiosity and desire, I got to say, I feel like they do the same amount of work to figure out really what's on the inside of this stuff. When I come into contact with it, I feel and I hear it as something very real, you know?
Quantify it when you say when I come into contact with
it. So I'll say,
what's the it?
There's a young musician. His name is Emmanuel Wilkins. He's from, saxophonist from Philadelphia. He's mid-20s now. Maybe he's 24, 25. And I met him when he was 15 in Philly. He was like, when are we going to play? And I was like, okay, first of all, you're like a teenager, so, you know, whatever, kid. But we stayed in contact. Then the next thing I knew, he was at Juilliard. And then I was like, all right. You know, and then the next thing I know, I needed an alto player to play a concert. And I said, let me call that kid. And that kid showed up, and he was probably 20. He showed up and played this very big concert I have dedicated to Thelonious Monk. And the saxophonist has the first solo alone by themselves. The band is not playing. And here came that moment in the concert, beginning of the show, and that saxophone solo happens. And he's playing on his own, and he's tearing the roof off of the place. And it's no lie. Everybody in the band is like, oh, shit. It's very real. Meaning, like, he played and cut the air in a way that we weren't accustomed to. Everybody had to level up to the kid. That's what is everybody's posture changed, and everybody could feel it in his intensity and his intention. Did he get everything right? No, I didn't care, because my goodness, did he awaken the band in that moment? I was like, and when I came back to New England Conservatory to work again with my students of the same age, I told them the story. I said, well, just so you know, guys, there's a kid out here wrecking shop. Just like you can. You know what I mean? I don't mean to put pressure on them, but I was like letting them know that, nah, you all can really come out here and change people's lives. You can not only change the audience, but you can change the musicians who you might even, you know, admire. You could really shift their path by really showing up with your full self intact and sharing it kind of wholly and openly. It's very difficult to get to that moment, but that's what I heard in him, and I've heard it with other musicians as well. It's always welcoming and gratifying.
Well, it's probably not coincidental that this was as part of your Thelonious Monk show. Mm. We've talked before about Monk. Mm. Let's just touch on him one more time for the people. Yeah. Your Thelonious Monk epiphany came when you first heard Round Midnight, and you continued to explore his sound world. Mm. I had a similar experience in that when I heard him, it changed how I heard things. Mm. Things that weren't as sharp or angular as Monk, mm-hmm. or as dissonant as Monk. Mm-hmm. For a while, it fell flat for me.
Right, interesting.
What did you take from Monk? How has your relationship changed with Monk mm-hmm. as you move forward in your jazz journey?
One of the aspects of Monk that keeps him interesting to me is that there's so much space in the music. So I always say his music is perforated, and it has enough space for you in it. So you have sometimes these very simple melodies that simply repeat over and over again. And you know, so you can kind of latch on to it. You can actually kind of learn it pretty easily too. It doesn't mean you're gonna play it well, but you will know the melody. And that for me is a great thing that he teaches in his music, that melody leads. And when he's comping for another soloist, he's often playing parts of the melody. He keeps singing it in his head. And it's a thing that I know that I've learned from him. But for right now, I've been focusing on Duke Ellington to celebrate his 125th birthday. So I have a series of concerts around the world playing his repertoire, mostly solo piano. And for Thelonious Monk, Monk cannot get to his sound if there is no Duke Ellington. Because when you hear Duke Ellington's sound, his piano sound specifically, his attack, the way he uses the range from the bottom to the top of the instrument, the way he choreographs moves, the way he uses the articulation, the punch he has with the attack, much of that Thelonious Monk has also taken into his tonal repertoire with his hands, his touch at the piano. Those things are like greatly, they're like tied together. Monk is the son of Ellington, really. It's that clear. That's what makes that.
And talk about melodies. Yeah. Ellington's king of the melody.
King of the melody. Wrote the melody, sang the melody until he died, you know, like, and in the way like Monk was like, nah, my songs are the ones that rule. For Ellington, my songs are the songs that rule. For Louis Armstrong, not necessarily the case. He sang other people's songs.
An interpreter.
Right? But for Ellington and for Monk, they led through composition, they led through attack of the instrument, and that makes them very different kinds of leaders, I think, because they really do try to champion their language. And we hear in the way Monk uses these, what people might call dissonance, I still call it harmony. The way he uses his harmony is that it's, I always hear the Southern slang.
Minor second,
Second, yeah, I'm sorry. Minor second formation of my two fingers next to one another is that's the slang from North Carolina that he brings up to New York. Ellington is the slang of D.C. that he brings to the city and to the world. And these are the things that I feel like, oh, when I'm studying them, that's what I start to understand. It's like, oh, how much slang they put in their playing.
I like this, like these dialects, Rocky Mount, D.C.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
No, it's very real. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another thing that I think goes with your wedding of past and present into future is this expansion. People call it multimedia. Mm. I don't like that because it makes me think of bad presentations with music, right? Like a slideshow with music. That's not what you do. Yeah. You expanded into the visual arts. Mm. That's a big part of what you do now.
Yeah.
How did that transpire for you? I was talking to your brother, Robert Glasper, mm. and, you know, he will say, yeah, sometimes I have to put text mm. on top of the music.
Right.
Because you can say that music is a universal language, mm. but if you really want to
yeah.
let people know what you're saying, sometimes words are necessary.
They are.
So, like, his use of spoken word
yeah.
in those groove-based, mm-hmm. flow-based, post-Coltrane mm-hmm. loops that
yeah.
he does
yeah, yeah.
are very important.
Yeah.
I think for you, this expansion into the visual
yeah.
has also been a crucial turn for you.
Yeah. Visual artists have been an important part of my development for years. And I'd say since 2005, for the past nearly 20 years, the collaborations with visual artists were as important to me as the collaborations I've had with other musicians. Maybe more important, because they layered in intentionality, which I'm not sure I was always learning as a, just playing music.
I need you to explain what that means.
So intentionality means, like, so why are you playing this song? Intentionality means you have to ask yourself why. The way the conservatory teaches music is they rarely ask you why. You say, oh, I play a G7 chord here. Oh, why? Because that's what it says on the page, and that says I got to go to C7 next. And those are the chord changes, so I have to do that.
But that's classical. There's less...
No, it's the same in jazz.
Okay.
It's the same in jazz. Meaning, like, people just are teaching you the music. With not necessarily saying, okay, so Coltrane wrote this song for Alabama because he's talking about the girls who were killed in that bombing of the church. Okay, so do you know why those children were killed in that bombing in that church, right? Do you know what songs that church was singing? Do you know what songs those girls knew and heard of? You know, do you know the conversations those girls were having right before that happened? Can you imagine what those girls' conversations would be like to today? So, okay, so now that's why we're learning the song Alabama by John Coltrane. And, you know, that's rarely opening up that far. You know, we're learning the song and learning how to play it. And the artists I knew, especially in 2005, two artists in particular, Joan Jonas and Adrian Piper, I ended up putting them on my Blue Note album called Artist in Residence because they were speaking very specifically about what their intention was as artists. And I was going to start challenging myself to do the same.
This intentionality that you're talking about, I think, is also just good performance practice,
yeah.
whether you're a musician. Or
yeah.
When you were saying it for music, I was thinking back in my community theater days mm. where it's not enough to know the lines.
It's not enough to know the lines.
You yeah. have to speak the lines from the script while actually thinking thoughts that your character might think.
Yeah. yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you have to be plugged in for the whole scene. It's yeah. not, I'm waiting for my turn to play, just yeah. as in jazz.
Yeah.
You're not waiting out this sax solo. You have to be deeply involved yeah. in what this yeah. saxophone is
and that's
doing.
Tiring.
Sure, sure.
You know what I mean? Like yeah. it's emotionally draining to work that way. But as with all things, if you build up the muscle, then you'll have stamina, you know, and you can exist and not be exhausted by every quarter note that happens to go by, whether or not the world depends on it, you know? And those are the things that I was asking myself as a person who was dealing with grief. My mother had just died, right? Like, so I was asking myself just in that moment, just like, well, okay, so why am I playing piano, continue to play piano? I mean, I know why. I think I like it, right? But those artists kind of helped me get through that grief to start to demand something more of my own music, even though it may have been there, but now I would really say, no, it's really here, and let's keep making music that can stand the test of time because it stands on more than just the sound.
Bringing in another dimension.
The visual brings in at least the part that I feel is missing for me. As a musician, of course, the frustration is you don't know what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Or there is nothing. And that's actually the beauty of it too. But working with enough artists, the artists also show me that there are more ways to understand your craft than simply by doing the part that everyone expects you to do. And working with specifically the artist Joan Jonas, she works in a way that during her performance pieces, she makes drawings during the pieces. And those pieces become, to a degree, the artifacts of the performance. And so what are all these concerts that happen at Carnegie Hall or here at Big Ears? What is the residue of that performance? Does it exist in the dust or the spit from the trombone valve, you know what I mean? Or the foot next to the bass drum pedal? Or on the piano, for me, then how does the piano register my attack at the instrument? And fortunately, working with Steinway all these years, I would go to the factory and ask for Steinway to give me a manual that I would, you know, they would separate from an instrument. And I would use these manuals, piano keyboard manuals, as kind of like my place to make these drawings. So I'd place a piece of paper over the piano keys, dump dry pigment onto the paper, and then play. And then take the paper away from it, dust off the pigment, and what remains is the register of my attack on this paper. And over the years, I mean, I guess it's been, I don't know, 7, 8 years now, 9 years, those works continue to kind of grow as what does anything. And thankful for a relationship, I mean, that Steinway can send me these manuals when I break them. that I keep having these manuals show up. I'm onto the third manual now. to have another opportunity to see what can come from registering these attacks.
We're live. We're live right now from Big Ears. This is not a Zoom.
No.
We're here in my unnamed hotel suite. Tell me about what you're here to do.
Sure. I'm here to play with legendary saxophonist Charles Lloyd, a saxophonist I've worked with for the past probably 13 years, maybe even longer. He just put out a new record called The Sky Will Be There Tomorrow on Blue Note Records. It came out last week. He just turned 87. He's still playing incredible saxophone and flute. The band is with Eric Harland and Larry Grenadier. It's a really great ensemble. So we play tonight. And then tomorrow, playing a piece that I just played at Carnegie Hall last week called From the Dance Hall to the Battlefield, which is dedicated to World War I pioneer, bandleader, and composer James Reese Europe. A record that I put out last year, but it's been music I've been playing for the past 4 or 5 years, animating his legacy as kind of like the first idea of the big band that Duke Ellington takes over. So James Reese Europe is there right at the beginning of this big change in American sound.
You've been sitting with that music for 4 or 5 years now. What has the evolution been?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's, you know, you play it enough, then people come up to you after the show and they say things to you like, you know, my grandfather was in the 369th Harlem Hellfighters. You know, like that's happened at Carnegie Hall. One of the things that also happened that we did for the first time at Carnegie Hall is we sang a song. Some of these songs have lyrics, but I, because of my own lack of singing ability, was not putting that part in the show. But I started singing the song All of No Man's Land is Ours at the request of Terry Gross. She asked to sing it in an interview, and then I pulled up enough courage to do that on a national platform. And then another artist, Ellen Gallagher, a great painter who's living in Rotterdam, she made an exhibition called All of No Man's Land is Ours because she heard that interview. And then I went to Amsterdam and played and sang that song there. Then I came back to the band. I said, okay, so look, we got to start singing this song. So now it's a moment where you hear these men's voices sing this song about no man's land. And for African-American men coming back from war, the no man's land was not pushing the Germans back. But no man's land continued to be, you know, you crossed the wrong side of Fifth Avenue when you returned to New York City. The no man's land was existing in the neighborhoods that they called home. That's the question that has to be, you have to say that out loud for people. It continues to evolve, and that's one of the ways.
As an untrained singer singing that song, you're not the first Black band leader to do that. You know what I mean? There's a rich history of jazz men who play also singing, and it's not their first instrument or even their second.
Yeah.
And that, there's an important, I think, pathos that comes with that because there's a vulnerability there.
Yeah.
And there's also a real humanism.
Yes.
Like, even if I think of, like, Ellen Duke singing It Don't Mean a Thing.
Right.
Right?
Right.
It's humorous, but it's also real.
Yeah, very.
It's
very.
That he's really doing this.
Yeah.
Do I 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 Rain, rain, go away. Come in some other day, boy.
Or even Louis Armstrong with the great way that he sings, like you or Tom Waits, or you know, or Nina Simone, you know, like then you understand that the vocalists who you love, they really are, they allow their character to be heard. And then there are people like Aretha Franklin who become the epitome of both piano playing and a, you know, like really incredible voice, you know, and all these voices. Then you say like, oh, they're not just out here, meaning I should muster the courage to also say the thing. And that does take courage to share publicly. And so, like I said, you know, I've been working up the courage to do this every time. So I just wrote my band this morning and say, practice, practice, practice.
In the wake of what you just said about intentionality, talk to me about the process. Let's say you're with Charles Lloyd and this band, and you guys are approaching a new tune, whether it's a new tune or a new tune for you or a new tune for that group. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me about the process of sitting down with that music and making it into?
You know, with Charles Lloyd as a band leader, he only wants you to explore. So he's not asking for you to repeat anything that he heard you do before. He just wants to hear what happens. Many times, even today during the soundcheck, when we were looking at a piece of music that we were all kind of learning together, when he hears just enough that it's going to be really great, he says, stop, save it. Save it for the show, you know? Part of playing music with him specifically is around the mystery and letting the mystery unfold for the first time on the stage.
So the mission becomes, let's create the conditions where that can happen.
Yeah.
Is that also your approach?
Yeah, to a degree. To a degree. I mean, I think we all have, as musicians, we have a sense of what we think the sound will be. And then hopefully you have musicians with you who can exceed what you have in your mind. So I always try to have musicians who are going to do that. So therefore, I won't ever be like, I more want it to sound like what I have here in my head.
Right.
Because that's not...
Because who cares?
Right. Yeah, it's also not as interesting. You know, like the things that I hear...
This can't be real.
The mind can't be real.
Yeah.
And also, like, I could never come up with the kind of bass line that Taras Mateen would play on his bass, or I never could write down the rhythms that Nasheed Waits plays on the drums. I never could imagine that stuff. So it's also like you hire people for a reason. You work with them and collaborate with them because they can excel and push an idea past where, you know, you had just the thought to pull it together, to put it on the table, but then you watch them really work the magic around it. And the magic is dedication.
Listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. We heard clips from Planet Rock from Jason Moran's album Modernistic on Blue Note Records, Planet Rock by Afrika Bambaataa on Tommy Boy, Trans Europe Express from Kraftwerk's eponymous album on Warner Music, Round Midnight by Thelonious Monk on one of his dozen record labels, In My Solitude by Duke Ellington from one of the great jazz albums ever, Money Jungle, on Blue Note. Arizona Landscape from Jason Moran's album Artist in Residence on Blue Note, and It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing by Ella Fitzgerald and Duke Ellington from Ella and Duke at the Côte d'Azur on Verve. Our opening music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush, played on a Steinway Model M by me, Ben Finan. Our closing music is Charles Lloyd's Defiant Tender Warrior from The Sky Will Still Be There Tomorrow on Blue Note Records, featuring Larry Grenadier, Brian Blade, and Steinway artist Jason Moran. Question for the podcast? Email me at info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard. Message me on Facebook at Steinway or hit me on the gram at Steinway & Sons. Subscribe to Soundboard on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, or wherever you pod your casts. Thank you for listening. Steinway & Sons is the official piano of Big Ears Festival. Live from Big Ears, I'm Ben Finan, Steinway's Director of Content and Media Assassin. My guest has been Jason Moran. And if you still think we're that type, don't believe the hype.
The book of the new school rap game. Writers treat me like Coltrane, insane. Yes to them, but to me, I'm a different kind. We're brothers on the same mind, unblind. Caught in the middle end, not surrendering. I don't rhyme for the sake of riddling. Some claim that I'm a smuggler. Some say I never heard of ya. A rap burglar, false media. We don't need it, do we?
It's fake, that's what it be to you.